You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tuku ingoa, no mai hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 26th of January. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by producer Christina. How are you going?
I'm good, Jemima. How are you, thanks?
Fantastic. Thank you very much. We're also joined in studio by Alan. I always never know whether to say hello now, but I feel awkward not acknowledging that you're here. How are you going?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Jemima. Fantastic.
Yeah. Rightio, we have some good stuff coming up on the show for you today. If I akine, Christina starts off with Dear Science.
Yes. So Alan Blackman joins us live in the studio. We chat about the surprising magnitude of the Tonga eruption, a generational link between smoking and body fat, and a 150-year-old maths problem that might have finally been solved, which is pretty cool.
I speak to ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden, as we do every week, about the government's new mask regulations under the red setting and the upcoming news about rapid antigen testing for COVID-19.
I also spoke to Dr. Arinda Mbasu about rapid antigen testing and Aotearoa's Omicron response ahead of the government's announcement later today.
And finally, fingers crossed, we will also be speaking to Carlos Calderon from Oxfam Aotearoa about their work with a New Zealand company working to turn seawater into drinking water in Tonga. He aho o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tukapatui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395, or why mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. We podcast everything that goes on The Wire after the show. So if you've got somewhere to be halfway through the show, or you tune in halfway through another show, you can always check out what we've done on the website, because it'll be there for you just after the show goes to air. But anyway, we've got lots of stuff coming up for you, so we better get on into it.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Today we're joined again by Alan Blackman, live in the studio. We can't have Marcus Jones at the moment, so unless you want to put on a bit of a British accent, I don't know.
Don't tempt me. Oh, my goodness.
But we've got some exciting stuff on the show today. As we mentioned before, last week's Tonga eruption was a very explosive one, and obviously it had massive impact. Mm-hmm. New research is emerging that shows just how powerful this blast really was.
Yeah. I mean, any volcano you think of being big when they erupt, but this one was enormous on the grand scale of things. And so people, as you say, are busy trying to figure out just how enormous it was. So the things that they do know, for example, is that debris was up to around about 40 kilometres in height, up into the atmosphere, which is enormous. And so NASA have been looking at, obviously, satellite images, et cetera, of these sorts of things. And they have estimated that the amount of energy that was released in the actual explosion was somewhere between 5 and 30 megatons equivalent of TNT, okay? 5 to 30 million tons equivalent of TNT.
Goodness. Oh, my God.
So to put that into perspective, and for some reason, this is what everything gets compared to, I guess, in terms of explosions, is the Hiroshima atomic bomb. So that was 15 kilotons, 15,000 tons. Okay, so we're talking somewhere in the scale of 300 to 2,000 times more energy released in this explosion than there was in the Hiroshima bomb, which is utterly ridiculous. Yeah. Nature is scary sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very sadly, there are currently the 3 deaths in Tonga and there's 2 in Peru, believe it or not, from the tsunami that was generated by the explosion. So at the moment, I expect that the death toll is going to rise. There's been photos, before and after photos in the media of Tonga, satellite photos. And we were there about 4 years ago, lovely sort of beach resort up on the sort of northwest of the island. And it's just gone. I mean, there's before and after photos. There's nothing there.
It's shocking,
and
isn't it?
All the houses and everything just gone. So, you know, you poor people in Tonga, it's got to be tough. In terms of the science, so yes, there were tsunamis and tsunamis in the water, but also really interestingly in the air as well. And if you get a chance to look online, you'll see this fantastic infrared image of this circular wave just spreading out from Tonga and going right around the world. And really fascinatingly, so obviously this affected the air pressure all the way around the world. So once people knew that this was happening, all these amateur meteorologists are out there with their barometers and stuff like that, and they could track the wave as it went through their place.
Oh my goodness.
So they would see the pressure wave going around. And really and honestly, do get online and have a look at it, because it just looks like ripples in a pond. It's just really quite spectacular. And the interesting thing about this wave is that it's a two-dimensional wave, as it hugs the surface of the Earth. Now, normally, if you've got an explosion, say in the air, like, you know, fireworks or something like that, that's a big three-dimensional explosion. It goes in all directions. But when we're talking about these sort of explosions of volcanoes and stuff like that, they are two-dimensional and they hug the surface of the Earth. They don't go into the third dimension, presumably, and I'm sort of guessing here, just because of the mere weight of the atmosphere. It's you know, we don't think of the atmosphere as having any weight, but it's pressing down on us with an enormous force. And so this sort of forces the waves to go out sideways, and they form these perfect circles, spherical waves that go all around the Earth.
Just completely flat.
Yep. And so this went around the world in around about 35 or so hours, roughly. And it was traveling at about the speed of sound. So, you know, it's hoofing around there. And really interestingly, this was actually predicted way back in the 19th century, as many things were, by a French dude by the name of Pierre-Simon de Laplace. Now, those of you who have done any sort of maths or physics or something, you might recognize that last name, Laplace. He is a famous mathematician, but he predicted these sorts of waves. And the first example of the confirmation of that prediction was the very famous eruption of Krakatoa way back in 1883, where that was an island in what is now today Indonesia, and that just basically disappeared. There was an enormous blast.
Wow. Yeah.
And so this is what science can do, you know. This is I guess a manifestation of science and the predictive power of science and everything, and doesn't make life any easier for the people in Tonga. And, you know, obviously we're all thinking of you, so hopefully things are not as bad there as they look at the moment. But by crikey, what an enormous,
pretty scary,
enormous
those images
blast.
Really, really awful.
Yeah.
Just a small question that I've got on that. Obviously, you talked about the difference between Hiroshima and this volcano.
Yeah.
Are most volcanoes, when they erupt like that, to that sort of extent of energy being released?
Yeah, they will be. They're enormous. I mean, the biggest one sort of in my life, or the biggest two, I guess, there was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in sort of the 90s, and there was Mount St. Helens.
There's been a lot of
And again, the video of that is extraordinary. The whole mountainside just slips, and then it's gone. You know, so you're talking phenomenal amounts of energy. And again, I think sort of satellite photos showed that before this one blew up in Tonga, it got flooded, and so you can imagine sort of cold water on very, very, very hot magma.
Yeah.
you can imagine that's going to not be a good mix. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's really hard to kind of just process the scale.
I know. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. You like use those numbers and you're like, wow, that's a lot. Yep. Like, I know that's a lot, but it's,
but it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot.
On a lighter note, this
good.
It's related to genetics, and this one is quite surprising. Researchers have found a link between men smoking before puberty and then their descendants have a higher percentage of body fat.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
man. So, first of all, you sort of wonder how some research studies come to be. So who would have sort of thought, I'll see if there's a link between prepubescent cigarette smoking and body fat.
It's kind of like a study that's born out of it.
Going around asking their friends, going like, so did you smoke before puberty?
Exactly.
Like, are your kids, like, you know, like, what? That's just so strange.
Well, it's actually been shown. This is a study that has been done, and it's just been published this week from people at the University of Bristol. And, you know, as you said, what they found seems to be that there is some sort of a link between the time when your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents took up smoking and your percentage of body fat, which is
amazing.
You know, really quite bizarre. Now, this arises from a study that's called, I think, Child or Children of the 90s, I think, in the UK. Now, again, we've got a similar thing in New Zealand. We've got the Dunedin study, the famous Dunedin
Growing
study from 1973. It's called the Dunedin study.
It's amazing.
And all the kids who were born in Dunedin in 1973, they've monitored them right through their lives.
Yeah.
And
it's incredible.
Yeah.
I did an interview on it last year. If you're interested, do check out bfm.com, 95bfm.com. But it is a fascinating study, and they're still studying this group
of
people.
Absolutely, they are. Yeah. The cohort's fantastic. So.
Yeah, and they're all adults now. This point.
And so this study in the UK, so these are kids born in the 1990s, around about 14,000 children in this study. And what they found, so they did some research back in 2014 that they published, and they said that if a father had started smoking before puberty, and they said that puberty was 11 years of age, then his sons, but not his daughters, had more body fat than usual.
So there seemed to be some
sort of correlation then. And now what they've gone and done is they've extended this study to not only include the fathers, but also the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers. And so now as a result of that study, what they found was that the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers, if they started smoking at an age less than 13, then their female descendants, so the female descendants of the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers, they end up having more body fat than those whose grandfathers and great-grandfathers started smoking between 13 and 16. So that's the comparison then.
Right.
So seemingly the earlier you started smoking, the more intergenerational these effects are. And that's quite extraordinary.
Have they found sort of why that is? It a genetic change? Surely it has to be some sort of...
No, you're absolutely right. I'm sure it has to be a genetic change. If it's manifesting itself over two or three generations, it's got to be something.
Mutated, some sort of genetic thing for
Crazy.
Body fat. Yeah, it's that so bizarre.
And, you know, having said that, how they managed to isolate this particular variable from all of the other possible variables that are out there.
Yeah, that could have caused
I don't know. I'm not an expert on statistics by any means whatsoever. Those are what have been published. Those are the results that have been published.
Amazing.
And
as is
usual, more study is necessary, I think.
Yes.
So,
what a great starting point.
Yeah, totally.
Very
fascinating
interesting
stuff.
Info.
Yes.
Yep.
So we do have time for one more topic today.
Cool. Okay.
For all the chess fans out there, anyone who watched Queen's Gambit and immediately bought a chess board, you might find this one quite interesting. So there's a maths problem that is 150 years old, and it's relating to the number of queens on a chessboard, but it might have finally been solved after a century and a half.
Right.
Tell us
amazing.
More.
So those of you who know anything about chess will know that the queen is the most powerful piece on the board.
Yes.
And she can move straight ahead or to the side or diagonally.
Yes.
Okay. So that makes her extremely powerful. Now, the problem was first posed back in, I think, 1848, I think they said. And the question is, if you've got eight queens on a normal chessboard, which mm-hmm. is 8x8, mm-hmm. How many possible ways are there of arranging those queens so that none of them are attacking each other directly? So
right.
In other words, you can't have another queen on the same row or the same the rank or the file or the diagonal.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
That seems quite impossible.
Seems quite impossible. You might be amazed to know there's 92 ways of doing that.
Oh my goodness.
And that surprises me. 92.
It seems like it would just be
ways.
One.
I can't even think of one. I'm thinking zero.
So there's 92 different possible ways of doing that. Now, not content with having found the answer to that, and that took sort of a couple of years, way back in sort of the 1840s, 1850s or whatever, then they said, okay, well, let's not restrict ourselves to an 8x8 chessboard. What about an N by N chessboard with N queens on it?
Right.
Where N is any positive integer. Now, if you go N equals 2 and N equals 3, you can't do it. You can't put three queens on a 3x3 chessboard. Doesn't work. N equals 4, greater. You can do it, okay?
Wow.
So the question then is, how many different ways can you do it?
Right.
And it's quite easy to figure out, sort of for small numbers, you can do it by brute force and stuff like that. But what happens if you want to know, if you've got a million queens on a million by million chessboard, how many possible ways of that? Now, this is what mathematicians do for
why does it matter? But good for them.
I don't know, in the 1840s, I don't know if there's much else to do.
Why does it matter? Okay, so to the guy who just spent 5 years doing this, I think it matters quite I think it matters quite a lot.
Really. Sounds amazing.
So he's a postdoc at Harvard, mm-hmm. and his name is Michael Simkin, and he has just come out with an approximation, seemingly, to this problem. And he's found quite a simple equation after 48 pages of proof.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And basically the answer is, if you've got an N by N chessboard, then you've got 0.143 times N to the power of N ways of arranging those queens so that they're not attacking each other. Okay, so to give you some idea, again, we're talking big numbers before in the explosion.
And that's mean that you could just drop any number in there and that would work. Is that sort of the idea? Well, four and above
three,
potentially, there's, as usual, more to it than that. Yep. But so if you've got, let's say, a million queens on a million by million chessboard, then the answer, the different number of possible ways that you've got is a number that's got 5 million digits to it. 5 million digits.
My gosh.
Those are the different possible.
Hard to process.
Yeah. I know it is. It's too big. You can't wrap your head around it.
I can't even really imagine a chessboard so big. Because I'm like, are you keeping them like little mini chess, like normal chess, or are you doing giant chess? Because if it's giant chess, it would be massive.
Across the country.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. If you've got just a normal chessboard, 8x8 with eight queens on it, there's over 4 billion possible ways that you can arrange those queens. 4 billion.
That's
and of
amazing.
Those, only 92 are unique, in which they're not attacking each other. So this, you ask, why do you do it? This is a thing called number theory. I think part of maths called number theory, and people do this, and I find it fascinating. You know, all these big numbers. It's just amazing. And, you know, that keeps the mathematicians off the streets, I guess. I don't know.
Keeps them in Harvard and doing some more maths.
Michael Simkin over 5 years figuring this one out.
So there we go.
That is fascinating.
It is amazing, though.
And just to throw this in just before we finish, it's 199 years to the day since Edward Jenner died. So Edward Jenner, Mr. Vaccine.
Oh, Mr. Vaccine. What so would, important these
make?
Days.
What would he make of today, eh?
Yeah, it seems quite fitting that today is the anniversary, given that the number of boosters actually reached 1 million yesterday.
Oh, fantastic.
There you go.
Thank you,
Edward
Jenner. Thank you so much. Awesome. And thank you, James Phipps, the 8-year-old boy that he did the trial on. Without his consent, of course. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Raise a glass to James Phipps.
James Phipps, 8 years old. And I think Jenna gave him his house or something when he died as a thank you.
Oh,
but this was an 8-year-old kid.
Did he, before he tested it on this 8-year-old child, did he test it on other things?
No, I don't think
just
so.
Went this was straight this, to a person.
He was pretty sure this was going to work.
Yeah, it's going to work. We'll just see how it goes.
Wouldn't have passed the ethics. Not at all.
No.
Great. Well, that wraps up Dear Science for another week. Thank you again very much to Alan for joining us.
Always a pleasure. And thank you, Motat.
Absolutely. Yes. Always thank you, Motat. We love you, Motat.
Do go
and visit. They've got lots of awesome exhibitions on at the moment. You may have heard the ads. So if that's something that you want to get up to, go for it.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
You are on the Wednesday Wire with Jemima and Christina. We'll be right back with some good news pieces for you, but just after a little break.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
Seven. It could be another clue. Lust, envy. You can expect five more of these.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in six?
California, stay away from here. Don't come in here now. Whatever you do, stay away.
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there is.
Botico Beats with Enrique Morales, Miguel BD and Lance Bentley, plus DJ Bobby Brazuca. And tomorrow night, Comedy Night with Corey Gonzalez-Makawa and friends, followed by DJs Bobby Brazuca and Andy JV.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Do people think I'm a wimp?
Why? Because you're a plant-based yogurt.
Yeah, because I'm plant-based.
Nah, you're just really easygoing in your own special way.
I am, right? Once you get to know me, I'm pretty flex and fruity.
Fulfill your flexitarian dreams with Little Island's plant-based yogurt. Low in sugar, but high in calcium and probiotics. It's also, get this, extremely delicious.
Flex and fruity.
Little Island plant-based yogurt. Available in natural, vanilla, berry and summer fruits. Go to littleislandcreamery.co.nz.
Okay, I got up at 5 a.m. I waxed on my board, I waxed off my board, which was a mistake because then I had to wax it again. I'm ready to go surfing, bruh.
Did you watch Point Break?
Yes.
I don't know.
Come on, we do everything together. We're like Simon and Garfunkel. We're Hall and Oates, bruh. We're like the sexy twins from Bros. Let me come surfing with you.
Oh, damn. Actually, look at that. Solid zero on the west coast. Surf's off, Soz.
Come on!
The 95 BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to Pro Gear Photographic.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You're back on The Wire with Jemima and Christina. And just before, you might have missed Amina's Dear Science, so you can catch that one online at 95bfm.com. Now, ahead of the government's announcement this afternoon, there are a lot of questions regarding the Omicron outbreak and the government's response and the rapid antigen testing. I spoke to Dr. lost my voice for a second. Oh dear. I spoke to Dr. Arundam Basu about rapid antigen testing and Aotearoa's Omicron response ahead of the government's announcement later today. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. It's a great pleasure.
So first of all, how does rapid antigen testing work for anyone who doesn't know?
Okay, see, the rapid antigen testing work on the basis of, you know, using pre-configured antibodies onto a solution containing the actual viral particles. So for example, if somebody has got nasal secretions and these are then, placed on a test strip and it's mixed with a solution, and then what happens is this, that the test strip contains the antibodies to which the viral particles will then merge, and they'll give it a line. And that line will tell you, it's a red colored line that will tell you that, okay, this person has got the positive. If the red colored line doesn't appear on the test strip, then you know that that person is negative. It's not like RT-PCR, which uses genomic technology. Actually, the presence of the viral particles on the sample that are then picked up, or the viral antigens on the sample that are then picked up. That's why it's called rapid antigen testing. It's rapid because it takes very little time. So about half an hour or so, you can get the results.
How effective would rapid antigen tests be in an Omicron outbreak in New Zealand?
Will be effective because the rapid antigen testing, every test that's a diagnostic test, has got properties called specificity and sensitivity. So sensitivity basically is a measurement that tells you that if there is the disease, what is the extent to which the test can pick up. And specificity is if the person does not have the disease, what is the extent to which it can pick it up? Now, in case of the rapid antigen testing, in a situation such as New Zealand, where we do not have many, many cases of COVID yet, we will see that it is fairly useful because if the rapid antigen test is positive, then the person definitely has the disease. If the person has the disease, however, there's no guarantee that the rapid antigen test is going to be positive. There are false negatives. So the rapid antigen test comes out to be negative, but it's quite possible that the person will still have the virus. But where it really adds value is if you use this in the context of, say, a workplace or in a school where you have got an asymptomatic person and you test them using rapid antigen test, and then that person turns out to be negative, then you can ask that person to go self-isolate, and therefore you can protect the rest of the people within that confined space. So that's the real benefit of this particular test.
Mm. But some experts have made it clear that rapid antigen tests are less accurate than PCRs, which is the nasal swab, and they can return false negatives and positives, like you said. Is there any validity in the government ensuring that people who don't need to take a test won't accidentally return false positives?
Yes, and that's the point to understand, because I think this is the reason why they're quite pragmatic in rolling out first to specific groups of people or professionals. Because if these people turn out to be negative and then the test is repeated, and then they turn out to be, and then they end up with some symptoms, they will still be offered the RT-PCR to validate that whether they really have the problem or not, you see? So this is why it's not ready for everyone as a home testing kit so that people can test and do them.
Basically, overseas in Australia, the use of rapid antigen testing is quite prevalent. So how useful are they in avoiding queues and delays in trying to get a PCR?
That's right. I mean, it's useful. But remember that it is going to be really useful in a country like New Zealand, where we don't really have a lot of people who are suffering from, who do not really have the infection. Whereas in Australia, when the number of cases went up, it also meant that a lot of false positives were returned, you see. So this is the critical point to understand here. Low prevalence, these tests are going to work well. High prevalence, you will still get them, need to be validating them with the other tests, only because the false positives are going to go up a lot. And these guys, this test is associated with false negatives quite a lot.
Mm.
That is, the test is negative, but the person will still have the disease.
Absolutely.
So that's the thing, yeah.
In New Zealand, we're in quite a unique situation here because the Omicron variant is wreaking havoc overseas, and we have so far been largely untouched. So we can kind of tool our response based on what we see succeeding or failing overseas. Now, ahead of the announcement this afternoon, what do you expect the government's response to Omicron would be here in New Zealand?
I think so far, as far as we have seen, the government has taken a very pragmatic approach in trying to stay ahead of any kind of Omicron wave that can come. Having known that the modeling activities that have been, executed so far have indicated that there can be large number of cases. So this is the reason why you see the government has mandated mask usage. They have moved the country to a red light traffic zone, and with a view that people should get their booster shots and so on and so forth. So I think, in all fairness, those are the same lines of argument through which we can see a little bit more stricter and tighter regulations about the availability of the RAT for specific groups of people. Schools are opening. That's very important, particularly the children, mask usage, and those are the lines that we are going to expect to see more of these announcements are coming from. And in particular, it's very important to find out, contain the spread and mitigation of COVID in the community. This is the general line in which you're going to expect to see the announcements coming.
That was Dr. Arindam Basu from the University of Canterbury speaking to me about rapid antigen testing and Aotearoa's Omicron response ahead of the government's announcement this afternoon.
Thank you so much for that one, Christina. You're on the wire on 95BFM. We've got another two pieces for you coming up on the show, but while we call somebody internationally, we're going to play you a little song, and then we'll be back with somebody live on air from Oxfam. So here is Coco Solid with Architecture.
Discussion. accomplishments have repercussions. Now where you go is where he doesn't. Your place is now under construction. You cannot trust what you cannot quite see. These columns stare at me so righteously. A tower of strength is what you were to me. Another pillar in society.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
In the wake of the Tonga eruption last week, the islands are in desperate need of drinking water. Oxfam Aotearoa and New Zealand company Open Oceans have now teamed up to deliver drinking water to those affected by purifying seawater. And we have Carlos Calderon on the line from Oxfam Aotearoa to tell us more about this. Kia ora, Carlos.
Kia ora, Christine. Nice to talk to you. Yes, great. Well, Oxfam is working in Tonga since many years, but we are not present in the country or model. Actually, we are working through partners, and local partners are those who are bringing the capacity and those who are actually responding at this point in time in Tonga.
Really good to have this kind of support in the wake of such a devastating disaster. Now, after the eruption, in the immediate aftermath, what was the situation like in terms of water? Why is there no water, and why is this technology necessary?
Well, water right now is an immense need, and basically due to the ash that has covered many of the roofs and has damaged at some point the capacity of collecting water from the rain. Government has said that tap water, of course, in the center of Nuku'alofa is usable. However, in the rest of the rural areas, in the outskirts of main towns, water is a main issue. Many wells, for example, many groundwater sources have been affected by salty water, and therefore it needs to be desalinated as the only method to make this water drinkable again.
So you guys use a desalination unit, and these units were first developed 8 years ago in 2014 and are being utilized yet again. So how exactly do these units work?
Yes, that's correct. During Cyclone Ian in 2014, together with a Paihia company that installs desalination units for yachts, we came together with the idea of putting all together in a box and making portable. So very quickly they took the idea and they put it in a box. They even developed a training manual that helped us to go with the desalination unit, train all our local organization, which is the Tonga National Youth Congress, and they after that, they went with those desalination units to small islands that they don't have any other capacity. In a cyclone, you could imagine roof has gone, no capacity to collect water. If it's not rain, there is no other way, there's no other sources. So they quickly desalinate island by island, and we managed to build three of these desalination units together with this Paihia company called Open Ocean. And those have been working pretty much in Cyclone Gita in 2018 until now. They are still serving.
And they are quite efficient. I read that they desalinate seawater at 240 litres per hour, which is quite staggering.
Yes. In fact, there are other methods that could clean water faster. But the problem is that those methods, for example, filtering, those methods could only work when it's not salty water, or when it's surface water or even groundwater that has been polluted, but not salty water, unfortunately. So desalination is the last resort, but even with that, so 240 liters could provide drinking water to 600 people in one day.
Wow.
So that is enough in many cases. It's not the best scenario, but it's still far cheaper, for example, to provide water through desalination, costs around 0.05 New Zealand dollars a liter. And that's less expensive and less pollutant than using, for example, bottled water, because after you use the bottled water that costs probably one New Zealand dollar plus shipping cost, you have to dispose the plastic bottles, and that could make another problem after that. Yes.
What other challenges have you faced so far in this effort?
Well, with this volcano, the main issue was communication. We all have been struggling to regain communication with our partners. And at the beginning, we knew for certain what they were doing, despite we haven't fully re-engaged communication. Why? Because we practiced this before. We did it in two cyclones in the last 7 years. And once we regained communication at the end, like it was on a Friday last week, we came to know that they were doing exactly the things that they're supposed to be doing. Why? Because they are a fully standing organization capable to respond, leading. Of course, we know that the damage that Tonga has for the long run, still they are going to need further support from us. To continue the operations, they are requiring more desalination units because the damage is countrywide, and we need to keep supporting them on this.
And finally, how else can Kiwis support Tongans in the recovery effort?
Yes, since the beginning we were sharing the same concerns of the lack of communication with Tongan communities in Auckland, and all people from Aotearoa were communicating with us, and we're really looking into many ways to support. Honestly, the best way is to keep donating to organizations like Oxfam and any other that are also responding in Tonga, because the money is what they need to keep the local NGOs and local charities operations, and that is important, because it will keep cleaning roofs, making rainwater available back to the people, and in the meantime, purifying water where it's needed.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today, Carlos.
No, thanks to you for the opportunity. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you so much.
That was Carlos from Oxfam speaking to Christina about the Tongan crisis, and also about their water salination technology that allows people to drink fresh water there. You're on the wire on 95BFM. This is Jemima and Christina is here producing with me. If you have any thoughts on the show, do send us through a text on 5395. We'll be right back with our regular conversation with the ACT Party's Deputy Leader, Brooke Van Velden. We'll catch you soon.
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. 5 different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hop Butcher, New Leaf's trademark non-alcoholic beer brewed with kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer, without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
It's music.
95.
We're an underground radio station here. 95 BFM.
And we bring the truth.
The original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden. The government is set to announce the next two phases of their Omicron response today. And yesterday we did get a bit of an insight into that with the government's decision on changing mask mandates under red and also the plan to bring in more regular use of rapid antigen tests. So that is what I decided to speak to ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden about today, masks and rapid antigen tests and the ACT Party's position on these new decisions in the face of Omicron. I began with the new mask requirement that face masks must be actual masks rather than scarves and face coverings. Also, all workers mandated to be vaccinated must wear a medical grade mask at work. And I began by asking Brooke what ACT's position was on this decision. The government is set to announce the next two phases of their Omicron response today. Yesterday, we got an insight into what that decision might be with the changing of mask mandates under red and bringing in the more regular use of rapid antigen tests. I want to start with masks. The government is requiring that face masks be actual masks rather than scarves or other sort of face coverings, and also that all workers mandated to be vaccinated must wear a medical grade mask. Could you talk to me about the ACT Party's thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of the recent announcements that the government's made about Omicron really just point to a lack of preparation. And firstly, I would ask that everybody looks at what the requirements are, because they are going to be changing over the next few days, realising what their requirements are and following what the government's advice is. But it's not right for us just to follow the advice without asking the questions of why has this taken so long and what public health advice is this actually. If you look at what's happening in Victoria, they've installed 41,000 HEPA filters into classrooms, and our COVID minister has said that we're going to have 5,000 HEPA filters installed in classrooms across New Zealand by the mid of this year. Now, the whole reason behind these filters is they can actually strip Omicron particles from the air. Now, this has been rolled out across Australia now so that kids, when they're getting into school, have these filters ready for the new year. That hasn't been in place in New Zealand. Instead, we're asking children to wear masks and hope that they won't spread Omicron through classrooms.
However, we're behind making those moves in Australia, but we're also massively behind in our Omicron outbreak compared to Australia. Australia has huge, huge numbers of Omicron spreading through the community, and if they are, you know, ensuring that this will be these filters will be available at the beginning of the school year, that's all good and well, but they still have thousands and thousands more cases there than we do here. So are we not just moving in a very sort of similar fashion that the rest of the world is, because it is hard to keep on top of it when we're just constantly learning about these latest variants?
No, I think that's giving too much to the government. I think really what we're seeing is, even if we have fewer cases of Omicron because we've delayed the outbreak coming to New Zealand because of MIQ, we have had the time of being able to see what's been happening around the rest of the world while they have been battling Omicron outbreaks and seeing what things they've been putting in place. Firstly, you'd look at the HEPA filters for classrooms. But secondly, and it comes back to that point about preparation, about rapid antigen tests, you'd see the use of those in other countries throughout the world and Omicron countries. People are able to go to pharmacies, supermarkets, even vending machines to see whether they can get a rapid antigen test to make sure that they can keep their own health in check and keep everybody else around them safe as soon as possible.
I want to get on to rapid antigen tests shortly, but just to go back to that, to the mask point I made at the beginning, the question, do you support the change in the mask mandate, ensuring that people do wear actual masks rather than a T-shirt or a scarf?
Oh, look, I think it's probably quite clear that a T-shirt or a scarf is not going to give you the same protection that a mask would. I would need to look further into the details of the public health advice about why particular masks are better in different settings.
Now, moving on to the rapid antigen tests, we're expecting to see more information on this later today. But ACT has said that in regards to these tests, that the government is treating the public like children. Could you explain this?
Yeah, well, the whole problem with rapid antigen tests is that they should have been brought into the country so much longer ago. You know, we were calling for this about 6 months ago. The problem that I see is that we are expecting New Zealanders to be grateful that there's now a new test that's available only for critical workers. But if you look at Australia, they have 67 brands of different tests that they can have approved, while MedSafe is only allowing us a few. We should be allowing anybody to import their own rapid antigen test for their own personal use, because the real problem here is that only if critical workers can get out of isolation from a negative test from a rapid antigen test, when everybody else has to isolate for 14 days, we're going to see a lot of people flouting the rules, not going to get tested because it means locking yourself indoors for 2 weeks.
Now, I'm not massively read up on the effectiveness and sort of the MedSafe sort of qualification when it comes to rapid antigen tests, but just to sort of make a parallel between some of the news that has come out when people have been buying online their own medical grade masks that are actually not medical grade under MedSafe and are using those thinking they're safe and thinking that'll keep them protected and then it won't. Is there not an argument for the same thing for rapid antigen tests that are not MedSafe approved and people importing those and potentially not providing the same quality result as MedSafe approved rapid antigen tests?
I think what we're seeing here is people are so eager to get their hands on items that they think will keep them safe. They're going to buy items that won't necessarily keep them safe, like you pointed out. But the issue there is that we have such a slow pharmaceutical approval process in New Zealand, and it doesn't seem clear to me why we have to ask MedSafe to go through an approval process that everybody else around the rest of the world would have to do too. There's no new information that MedSafe will find about masks, about rapid antigen tests, that the TGA in Australia, the FDA in the US and the UK version wouldn't already have. So we'd say that if the US and Australia and the UK all say that a rapid antigen test is safe and should be able to be used, that should have automatic approval in New Zealand.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Wednesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning in and listening. We always love knowing that you're out there listening, so do always send us through a text on 53955. We really appreciate your feedback. Massive thank you to you, Christina, for producing the show. How do you feel?
I feel like it was a bit chaotic this morning, but we did pull it together at the end.
We did pull it together. It's always, you know, it's always a little bit tricky on the wire, but it always comes through, which is good. So thank you so much again. And a huge thank you as well to the people who contributed to the show today. We always appreciate the time that people give us. It's really, really amazing. And we feel very lucky to be able to have those opportunities with people. Up next is the 1-4 with Bridge, so do stay tuned. And then after that, you'll have the Drive show, and that's where you'll get to hear some more news with our couple of bulletins in their show there. And then The Wire is, again, at midday every other day this week, so do stay tuned in. And we will catch you next time with some more good news. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.